I'll ask Gary Marshall to call the next case for presentation.
The first one is A19-0628, Hugh Allen Hanshew respondent versus Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company.
Good morning. You're familiar with appellate court procedure. Take your time setting up, but when you're ready to proceed, appellate counsel, go ahead and approach the podium. You can, there is a switch if you need to adjust the podium up or down.
May it please the court, counsel, and Mr. Cantrude. My name is Chad Hintz. I represent the appellant in this appeal, Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. MLM is here to ask you to reverse the trial court's decision because it has neither a duty to defend nor indemnify Mr. Cantrude in a malpractice case brought by his former clients, Joel Holstead, and his company. The applicable MLM policy that's at issue runs from July 1st, 2016 to July 1st, 2017. It's a claims-made policy. Mr. Cantrude first reported the malpractice claim to MLM in December of 2016. It does not fall within the coverage grant of the unambiguous language in the MLM policy because it was deemed made prior to July 1st, 2016. And when you're dealing with a claims-made policy, notice to the carrier is what triggers potential coverage.
Well, here's the theme I heard throughout the my review of the matter. Every time you represent a client, you'd have to notify your insurance provider that maybe there's a potential claim. I mean, how do you know if a client's going to bring an action against you? You don't know that.
That question is answered by looking at the coverage grant and how it defines when a claim is deemed to be made. And that happens in two circumstances. The first one is if a third party makes a demand for damages that arise out of your professional services. That's some third party telling you they think you screwed up.
But that didn't happen here.
That didn't happen here, and that's not what's at issue. But under the policy, a claim can also be deemed made when an insured first becomes aware of facts that could reasonably support a claim. And to answer your question directly, the reasonableness component of that test provides a limitation on when an insured has to tell. So you do not have to tell in every circumstance if you do not think you screwed up and that belief was reasonable. If there's a reasonable basis to believe you're aware of facts that could support a claim, it must be reported because it's deemed made. But if it's unreasonable for you to come to that conclusion as a lawyer, you don't think you screwed up, and a reasonable lawyer in your shoes would come to that conclusion, then you don't have to report it. That's the way the claims made policy works, and it's different than an occurrence policy. And I can explain the distinction because there's an argument that's being made that the way we're asking you to interpret the policy turns this from a claims made policy into an occurrence policy, and that's not right. The reason it's not right is the best way to explain it to you.
Something in between, which would be the hybrid policy.
Right. The best way for me to explain the concept to you is just give you an example, okay? Let's say in policy year number one, a lawyer is representing a client, and that lawyer is required to commence litigation, otherwise the statute of limitations is going to run. Now, if the lawyer fails to sue the case out in a timely manner during year one and learns of his or her failure, that there are reasonable basis to conclude that a claim could be brought against the lawyer. It's been deemed made, and the lawyer's got to report it in year one in order for coverage to apply. But let's say that the lawyer blew the statute in year one, but didn't know that he blew the statute. A couple years pass, and he learns when he's reviewing his inventory of cases in policy year three, oh my gosh, this one slipped through the cracks. I blew the statute of limitations. This should have been sued out a couple years ago. Well, that's the awareness piece of it. He first became aware in year three that a claim could be, that facts exist to reasonably support a claim because he blew the statute of limitations. His obligation to report is in year three, and the year three policy would apply. And if this was a true occurrence policy, when he blew the statute in year one, that policy applies, no questions asked. And that's not what the unambiguous language of the policy, the MLM policy at issue here says. And if we look at the stipulated facts of the parties in this case and keep those concepts in mind, in January, if Mr. Cantrude represented Joel Holstead and his company, they were defendants in an underlying case against another title company. The plaintiffs in that case in January of 2015 brought a motion to compel, actually for summary judgment or alternatively to compel discovery responses. The court issued its order compelling discovery in February of 2015. It stayed the summary judgment motion, and it said essentially, you guys work it out. And if you can't work it out, the plaintiff in the underlying action can file and serve an affidavit explaining the deficiencies. And if Mr. Cantrude's clients don't agree with those deficiencies, they are to file an objection and, in addition, schedule and serve a notice of a hearing to be heard on why default judgment should not be entered against them. They did nothing. The plaintiffs then moved for default judgment, and by an order dated April 2015, the trial court granted default judgment against Mr. Cantrude's clients. And it was very careful on the stipulated facts that you have before you that the reason the court dismissed or granted default judgment and struck Mr. Cantrude's clients' answers was because they failed to avail themselves of the procedures that the February order required. Namely, they failed to request a hearing and serve a notice of a hearing. And that was the reason default judgment was granted. Mr. Cantrude, in an affidavit in that underlying action, has admitted that it was his job as the lawyer for these folks to make sure filing deadlines were met. And he didn't do that here. And in 2015, he knew that it was his job, and he knew that his clients got a default judgment entered against them because they didn't follow the filing procedures as set out by the trial court. And when you have that knowledge in 2015, the test is, what would and it's an objective test, what would a reasonable lawyer in Mr. Cantrude's shoes do with that information? And when you look at the deemed language in the policy, it says, when you're aware of facts that could reasonably support a claim, i.e., it was my job to make sure stuff was filed on time, because the trial court said in this case, we needed to do this, it didn't happen, and now there's a default judgment against my clients, that's a reasonable basis to support a claim against the lawyer. It triggers an obligation to report to MLM, and when that matter was not first reported until a new policy had issued, there's no coverage because it falls outside of the coverage grant of the applicable 2016-2017 policy. That's the analysis. In response, the respondents do not tackle those facts and analyze them in any meaningful way. Instead, they say, you know what? Mr. Cantrude's clients, there was a whole lot of bad stuff going on with regard to discovery and how they were litigating the case. I didn't perceive that to be my fault, so I had no idea I was going to get sued for that conduct. And that's fine. That might be true, but you cannot ignore the language that says, or the facts that talk about why default judgment was entered in the first place. And the MLM policy specifically says, it's at page 4-09 of the policy. The easiest way to find that is in the respondent's addendum at page 12. It says, and that deals with the situation, what if you've got multiple things that form the basis of the claims? Well, the policy says that if multiple acts arising out of the same or related services form the basis of the claim is deemed made when the first claim is deemed made. And here, taking the undisputed facts without question, the first claim was deemed made in 2015. Or at best case scenario, they appealed the trial court's decision. And this court, in an order of February 2016, affirmed the default judgment. And that decision talks about the district court providing a deadline to request a hearing and the failure of Mr. Cantrude's clients to avail themselves of that remedy is the reason the district court dismissed the case and that decision was affirmed. And that's in 2016, February. If we fast forward, they petitioned the Supreme Court, review was denied in April of 2016. 2 months later, Mr. Cantrude filled out an application to renew his insurance with MLM. And on the renewal form as part of the application process for everybody, if you're renewing it or if you're a new insured seeking a policy with MLM, they ask the question, has any firm member become aware of any incident which could reasonably result in a claim being made against the firm or a member of the firm?
Do you agree that the duty to defend is broader than the duty to indemnify?
Absolutely. We're here because the late notice means that this claim falls outside of the coverage grant in its entirety.
You know, and for that, since it is broader, we would have to understand from the record that it conclusively establishes you have no duty because he was aware of his acts or omissions.
That's right. Taking the fact, and the parties, the way they did it is we submitted documentation attached to my affidavit that created an undisputed.
You know, in looking at this record, it and the Court of Appeals decision and Judge Shannon's decision, you know, it seems as if the clients were at fault, at least, well, that the clients were at fault for some of the ways they did. So therefore, you know, unlike the statute of limitations deadline, where, you know, if I, you know, the deadline's the deadline, and, you know, I mean, that's sort of crystal, you know, I mean, if you had to bring it by January 1st and you brought it on January 2nd, well, then, you know, you blew it. But here you're asking Mr. Cantrude to, based on this record, to conclusively believe that it was clear to all he and he alone was at fault as opposed to the Holsteads and their actions, one of whom was an attorney. And what I'm getting at is it so absolutely clear under an objective standard that an attorney would know that there was a malpractice claim coming as opposed to, you know, just knowing, boy, I don't want to represent those people again.
Well, it gets back.
And that's what I'm getting at. What would I point to say, yep, anybody who was there would know that this claim was coming from, what's their names? Holsteads.
Joel Holstead and the title company. Because when you're a lawyer representing a client in litigation and you get a court order that tells you if the other side is going to move for default, you need, if you want to object to that, not only do you need to file a written objection, but you also need to schedule a hearing and file a notice of that hearing so that you can be heard. When a court tells you to do that, and you've acknowledged that that's your job to make sure that happens as the lawyer, and you don't...
The client has instructed you not to...
That's not... The record here is that his affidavit said it was my job.
Oh, good point. There is no record evidence.
Right. The record before us is that he admitted it was his job. And taking an objective view of that, a reasonable lawyer in his shoes would go, I've got a problem here. I need to take a look at my malpractice policy, and if you read it, the terms are unambiguous, and the result is when you become aware of that, you have to give MLM notice. And it gets back to that... the language at page 409 that says if, you know, he was representing him in the litigation, there was more than one thing going on, but if there's a set of related circumstances, the claim is deemed made when the first one occurs.
But, and I agree with you lawyers should answer discovery. But, you know, the record, you know, your coverage denial letter, you know, specifically addressed our opinion. And in that opinion, you know, we said, the record does not conclusively establish that the Holsteads were innocent in failing to adequately and timely respond to First American's discovery request. This is especially, and that's in the case of, you know, well, do you get to blame the lawyer, do you get to blame the clients to reopen a default
right.
motion? So looking on that, and, you know, you make great star that, well, by God, he had a copy of the opinion and, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, I would look at that opinion and say, well, you know, it's not so clear it's all my fault. The Court of Appeals is suggesting it's the client's fault. And if it's equally the client's fault, then is it absolutely clear on an objective standard that the lawyer had the obligation to notify his carrier that, you know, trouble's, you know, no question about it, trouble's down the road or trouble's coming, as opposed to, you know, it's not so clear that it's coming, and therefore, under the policy, I didn't have the obligation to inform you.
Yeah, I will answer the question. I see the red light is blinking, but to address what you're saying, not seeing it coming because you're not sure if they're going to communicate to you that they want to sue you for malpractice is one part of the deemed made test. But the other part is, when you become aware of facts as the attorney that could reasonably support a claim, you have an obligation for coverage to apply under a claims made policy to tell the carrier about it. And if you do that at the time you learn of it, not only is that going to be covered, but all the related services as well are going to be covered under that policy because you reported it. But if you don't report it, and then it's a claim is brought that involves at least part of what you were aware of, in the future, those future policies don't cover it. And that's the way the policy language works. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Hintz. You'll have 5 minutes for a rebuttal.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Scott Wilson. I represent the respondent, H. Allen Cantrud, who is seated on my left in the courtroom with us today. The district court's decision is an ordinary application of established law. To understand why, it's important to appreciate exactly where we are in the insurance landscape, as you've already recognized, Judge Connolly. This case is about duty to defend. It is only about duty to defend. For its own reasons, MLM chose to waive any issues on this appeal with respect to duty to indemnify. On that footing, there's some law that this court must account for in making its decision. In Farmers and Merchants State Bank in 1976, the Minnesota Supreme Court said about duty to defend, quote, if any part of the cause of action against the insured arguably falls within the scope of coverage, the insurer must defend. And if there are any doubts about whether the insurer has that obligation, those doubts, quote, should be resolved in favor of the insured. Given MLM's unusual and counterintuitive definition of claim and its provision with respect to when a claim is deemed made, and against the background of this stipulated record, coverage is at least arguable, and there is plenty of doubt, some of which you expressed, Judge Connolly, as to whether MLM has an obligation to defend. So what the district court did was both predictable and correct, and the district court should be upheld in granting summary judgment on the question of duty to defend. There is one other point to be made, though. In addition, MLM's definition of claim, which includes the circumstances that could reasonably lead to a claim, and its coverage grant, which provides that a claim is deemed made when the insured is aware of those circumstances, serve to convert the policy from a claims-made policy into a kind of a hybrid claims-made slash occurrence policy. just as the district court found. Actually, the district court drew a straighter line. It said this converts a claims-made policy into an occurrence policy. That defeats the reasonable expectations of the insured, and that's another basis on which the district court should be upheld in granting summary judgment on the question of duty to defend. I'm going to turn to each of those two arguments in greater depth. First of all, MLM has a duty to defend Mr. Cantrude. It's insured in the underlying malpractice litigation. Under an ordinary claims-made policy, and I think this is an important point to set up the background of an ordinary policy, under an ordinary claims-made policy, the insured has an opportunity to trigger coverage by giving notice of an occurrence that might lead to a claim. The occurrence itself is not treated as a claim. If an insured falsifies an application for a new policy period by failing to disclose the occurrence, the relief available to the insurer is rescission, not denial under a coverage definition. Here in this case, MLM's definition of a claim essentially includes the occurrence itself. What the policy says a claim is, among other things, quote, any act, error, or omission by any insured which could reasonably support or lead to a demand for damages, close quote. You would think that only the demand for damages would be the claim. But under the policy definition, no, the occurrence itself is also a claim. MLM's coverage grant indicates that a claim is deemed made, quote, when an insured first becomes aware of any actual or alleged act, error, or omission by any insured which could reasonably support or lead to a claim. So under that language, a claim is deemed made based on the insured's awareness, not on the actions of the claimant. Essentially, that puts coverage on a hindsight basis for the insured. That's what that does. If the insured can correctly predict the claim and give notice in the coverage period, then there's coverage. If not, then there's no coverage. That matters in duty to defend analysis, because the question is just whether or not coverage is arguable. Here, there were a series of problems that occurred in the First American litigation. The client, Joel Holstead, avoided service, took unreasonable positions in opposing discovery. The predecessor lawyer for Mr. Cantrude, representing Mr. Holstead, failed to timely answer the complaint, brought a groundless motion to dismiss. And all of that occurred before Alan Cantrude became involved as a lawyer in the case. And actually, I want to direct you specifically to where you can see that in the record. Counsel for MLM stated before you a few minutes ago that the reason that the trial court defaulted Joel Cantrude and National Title was Mr. Cantrude's failure to follow specific procedures. Actually, the trial court identified multiple problems. You can find that in Exhibit 7 to the Hintz Declaration, which is essentially our stipulated record. And in Exhibit 7, Judge Hannon itemizes a number of reasons that she is refusing to allow a motion for reconsideration of the default judgment. She says that there is a pattern of misconduct in National Title Resources Corporation and Joel Holstead, including attempts to evade service, failing to timely answer the complaint, untimely serving a motion to dismiss that ultimately lacked a factual legal basis, and then the other reasons, failure to respond to discovery, insufficient responses, failure to pay the attorney fee judgment. So that's actually what's in the record with respect to the trial court's reasoning. Now, I want to be clear. Mr. Cantrude didn't do things perfectly in representation of Joel Holstead, most notably in his failure to follow the trial court's specific procedures for resisting the default. He did object to the default. He didn't follow the specific steps laid out by the trial court, and he should have. But a reasonable attorney in his position might have looked at the totality of those circumstances and thought the following. Okay, if I had followed the trial court's specific procedures, the result probably would have been the same. The trial court probably would have entered a default judgment based on these facts. Given that, and looking at all of that, my omissions aren't the substantial cause of the default. So I don't have, reading the policy, knowledge of an act, error, or omission which would reasonably support or lead to a demand for damages, not against me at any rate. And therefore, I don't have to give notice to MLM. Now, here's the important point.
And that's an objective standard.
That is under an objective standard. If it's reasonable, if it's arguable, again, in this context of duty to defend. If it is arguable
because they were, well, because the clients were as responsible for this bad, well, were arguably as responsible for this bad result as I am, and since it's equal, I don't have a reasonably objective attorney would not report it because it's like, you know, they're the ones, I got into this after the torpedo hit the battleship, and now I'm just trying to get everyone off the battleship, but I didn't sink the battleship, and so therefore, you know, don't blame me for the torpedo hitting the battleship. I mean, is that sort of what we're talking about?
I like your analogy. I would extend it a little bit in this case. I'd say I came on board after the torpedo hit the battleship. I may not have evacuated the battleship as well as I might have, but I am not responsible for the sinking of the battleship. And the question before this court is if it's arguable that a reasonable attorney, that objective standard, could conclude that, then there's coverage. Because then the claim, even under MLM's convoluted definition, doesn't occur prior to the 2016-2017 policy period. It only occurs when common sense would say it occurs when Alan Contrude was sued, which was during the 2016-2017 period. The district court understood that. It saw the arguable coverage, and it granted summary judgment on duty to defend. And the district court should be upheld in that respect. Now, there's also another reason, as I referenced, that the district court should be upheld. The district, this was, to some extent, implicit in the district court's ruling. There wasn't a citation of Atwater Creamery that I saw in that decision, but there was some reference to the insured's reasonable expectations in that decision. Here's my assertion. By including knowledge of an occurrence in its definition of claim, MLM defeats the reasonable expectations, not just of Mr. Contrude, but of all of its insureds who are subject to this policy. The reasonable expectations doctrine is a limited tool, but it is appropriate for exactly the circumstance that we're looking at in this case. Here's what the Minnesota Supreme Court said in Carlson in 2008, which is, I think, the last time it really spoke to reasonable expectations. Quote, in Atwater, we held that where major exclusions are hidden in the definitions section, the insured should be held only to reasonable knowledge of the literal terms and conditions. This case is Atwater because the policy contains definitional and coverage-granting language that contains a massive exclusion for unrecognized occurrences. As the district court recognized, that turns a claims-made policy into what the district court called an occurrence policy, but I think we all agree is really a kind of a hybrid claims-made slash occurrence policy. It requires de facto that the occurrence defined as a claim and the actual claim, the demand or the suit, occur in the same policy year. The MLM's definitional gymnastics, and that's what I would call them, should be disallowed under Atwater. A claim should be understood as the district court expressly understood it, quote, a request or demand made with an insurer for the payment of funds or provision of services. That's under the Claims Practices Act, 72A-201-sub-3-3. That's also consistent with the terms of the policy. And that is the way that the term claim is reasonably understood in English and in law. The district court's grant of summary judgment as to duty of defense should be upheld on the reasonable expectations ground as well. So
but
based on...
the exclusion clause
yes.
here wasn't hidden. It was on the first... wasn't it on the first page of the policy, the first section?
It would be difficult to hide anything in this policy, Judge Klepacki, because it's relatively short as they go. So I wouldn't assert that it's hidden. I would say it's a massive exclusion in an unexpected and counterintuitive place. And it's also a very unusual approach to malpractice coverage. So I assert it qualifies for Atwater treatment on that basis. It's not hidden in 50 pages of fine print, no. But it sure as heck isn't where you would expect it, and it does not say what you would expect it to say. And it does fit the Atwater pattern in that it is an exclusion hiding in a definition.
I mean, we don't have to get to any of that.
You do not.
Yeah. If we believe an objective, if it's arguable that an objective attorney wouldn't have reported this based on the language in our opinion.
Yeah. Well, of course, as a technician, Judge, I think this is a lovely opportunity for the court to further refine and expand Atwater. But as an advocate, if you want to rule in our favor based
God
on our
forbid.
First argument,
God forbid.
Yeah, then by all means, do not reach reasonable expectations. If there aren't any further questions, I have a little time left, but I'll yield it. Based on all of that, Respondent Cantrude requests that the district court be upheld in all respects, and on this footing, given the waiver of indemnity defenses, that means affirmance of judgment against MLM, both as to duty to defend and duty to indemnify. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson.
Two points. The first one is I want to talk about what was on the ship when the torpedo hit it from the Cantrude camp. And I don't want to lose the distinction of what, if you read the malpractice complaint, Mr. Cantrude's not being sued for stuff that occurred before he took over the representation, for the untimely filing of an answer by Joel Holstead, for an untimely motion to dismiss on the pleadings. He's not being sued for that. He's being sued because of the way discovery was handled. That discovery was the subject of the motion to compel, where the trial court said, if the other side is moving for default, you need to file an objection and request a hearing and serve notice of that hearing. It's all related, and that's what he's being sued for. And he knew in 2015, and certainly by 2016 when the appellate remedies were over, that the reason the court, at least in part, dismissed it was because the trial court believed that they failed to avail themselves of the procedures. There's a comment that a reasonable lawyer in his shoes might say, geez, that result would have happened anyway. But that's not the operative point. The point is, by failing to file and note a hearing to be heard, he lost that ability to show up in front of the trial judge and make the arguments. And when his client's legal rights were lost because he failed to follow the procedures, and he admits that it's his job, a reasonable lawyer in his shoes was aware of facts that could support a claim. So how does that apply to the policy? I was paraphrasing earlier when I talked about that provision in the coverage grant at page 409, but it says, all claims arising out of the same or related professional services shall be considered one claim and shall be deemed made when the first claim was deemed made. He's being criticized for the way he handled the discovery, including the way he failed. And the malpractice complaint at paragraphs 38 to 39 talk about the failure to request a hearing in front of the court as the cause of the default judgment. Those are all related, and under the unambiguous language of MLM's policy, it's considered one claim, and you've got to report it because it's deemed made when the first claim is deemed made under the policy, and that's his awareness and an objective view of that by a reasonable lawyer in his shoes. The second point I just want to touch on is the reasonable expectation.
Let's explore that.
Yeah.
So let's say it's a default hearing, and, you know, among the default hearing factors are, you know, do you have a claim in the merits? You know, did you default? And then how long did you wait before, you know, you brought your motion to vacate? And let's say, you know, the client, you know, that the delay in bringing the motion to vacate is 6 months, and half of that is, you know, the client, you know, was shopping around for lawyers and, you know, couldn't find one who would take the case, you know, what a surprise, for 3 months. And then let's say the other 3 months is due for whatever reasons the attorney didn't bring it. You know, I mean, what? Who cares? He didn't. And the court's opinion says, and, you know, another, and you know, let's not get into the debate of, you know, whether 6 months is too long or too short. I mean, my God, I think we've got opinions all over the block on, you know, the time period. But let's say in reaching its ruling, the court says, oh, and by the way, you know, I'm denying the motion for default judgment, and one of the reasons is 6 months is too late, okay? Are you saying, under that circumstance, under this policy, an objective attorney should, and then the court, you know, what a surprise, you know. You know, clients always sue their lawyers because, you know, whatever. The client sues in default, and are you saying under those facts, are you saying an objective standard attorney should have contacted his carrier and say, you know what, it's coming because, you know, I was I was responsible for some of those 3 months, and the court said, you know, 6 months is too long. Are you saying you should have? Period. Are you saying he should have notified his carrier?
I think it depends upon the language used by the trial court.
6 months was too long.
Okay, and the lawyer was responsible for a 3-month delay. Under those circumstances, if the lawyer played a role in why the client lost the case, then that lawyer, on an objective view, he would have a reason to believe that he would be aware of facts that could reasonably support a claim if he plays a role in why the client lost his or her case. That's what the policy says, and it's all considered one claim when they're related.
Time has expired again. I need to point that out.
Sure.
Thank you. Thank you to both attorneys for appearing today and arguing on behalf of your
And if that's the case, thank God I don't practice law anymore.
The matters were well briefed and well argued. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame.
Thanks, Judge.
Thank you.
We have one case remaining on our oral argument calendar. I'll ask our marshal to call.